We're going back nearly 2,000 years to Jerusalem, a time of political unrest, with people and buildings being destroyed in the pursuit of power, control, and land. It'd be nice to think that wasn't happening today, but it's just the same now as it was, unfortunately, 2,000 years ago. And we've been looking at the eyewitness account of Jesus' life written by Matthew. And as I said, we're nearing the end of the book with just a few chapters to go. Jesus has been preaching, teaching, performing miracles over the last 3 years. And he's arrived in Jerusalem ahead of Passover, and he's been betrayed by one of his disciples, arrested, and is now being taken to trial. And I've called it Trouble in the Family Business. That's not a very good title at all, so just ignore that. I was just pressurized by Becca. Come up with a snappy title. So I came up with that and then wish I hadn't. So let's just crack on with the... I'll allude to it, but it's not really the most important thing of the passage by far. Here's what it says in Matthew chapter 26. Those who had arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas the high priest, where the teachers of the law and the elders had assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance, right up to the courtyard of the high priest. He entered and sat down with the guards to see the outcome. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. But they did not find any, though many false witnesses came forward. Finally, two came forward and declared, "This fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is the testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent. The high priest said to him, "I charge you under oath, by the living God, tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God." "You have said so," Jesus replied, "but I say to all of you, from now on you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, "He has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard this blasphemy. What do you think?" "He is worthy of death," they answered. They spat in his face, struck him with their fists. Others slapped him and said, "Prophesy to us, Messiah. Who hit you?" This is a right shambles. In Matthew 26, verses 3 to 5, we read that a few days earlier, Caiaphas and the other leaders specifically said, "Do not arrest Jesus during the Passover." It's a bit like deciding on the 23rd of December, I know what we'll have in our house, we'll have a new bathroom suite, and we're going to do it on Christmas Eve, and it'll all be done by Christmas Day. I mean, you're not going to do that, are you? But this is what happens here. We're in the middle of Passover, and Jesus gets arrested. Now, there's the timeline. If you're interested, you can read all about it in various versions or various eyewitness accounts where it all fits in. If the charge is blasphemy, which is basically taking God's name in vain, then the Romans will want a Jewish trial first. If Jesus claims to be king, they'll want a trial in front of King Herod. So they need a Jewish hearing, a Jewish trial, a civil trial, a county court trial, and finally a decision made by the Roman civil court. That is a lot of trials to get done in a very short space of time. How are they going to do it? Well, firstly, Jesus is taken to the nearest place where he is arrested, which is the house of Annas. Now, he used to be the high priest, but it's a bit like, I don't know if you work in a family business. I used to work for Clancy Dockra, and they're a family company. They're the people that dig up the roads, by the way, and they just say, "Clancy Dockra, digging up your roads," for the benefit of you. And it's run by the three children of the founder. So that's Mary Dermott and Kevin, and they run the company. However, once a month, when it's a board meeting, Mrs. Clancy arrives. That's their mother. And to be fair, I think we all know who's actually in charge of the business. It's definitely her. I did meet her quite a few times as she came once a month. She didn't really want to sit with me. She has her own dining room, by the way, in a separate, you know, but unfortunately sometimes somebody forgot to make the dining room, so she had to sit with the ordinary people. I think she didn't think I was the payroll manager. I think she thought I was the gardener because she kept asking me to dig up those weeds that were growing. Anyway, we've got a list here of the high priests. I'm going to put that. Here's a list of all the high priests from the time Jesus was born to 70 AD. And you can see Annas was indeed a high priest, but he stopped being a high priest in 15 AD. And now it's Joseph Caiaphas. He married the daughter of Annas, and he was high priest from 18 AD to 37 AD. But Annas still thinks he's really in charge. He's a bit like the father of the family business. He keeps interfering. And I personally believe he was the one that arranged for Jesus' arrest with Judas, much to the annoyance of everybody, really. For the Jewish leaders at the time, there were serious concerns about Roman rule. And there were some people, like Judas, who we heard about last week, who wanted to remove the Romans, preferably by force. That actually happened in 66 AD, and it was an unequivocal disaster. Anyway, back to 33 AD, which is what we're looking at now, and the Romans would not perform executions for violations of biblical law. So blasphemy would not have mattered to Pilate. So Caiaphas's position is to establish that Jesus was guilty not only of blasphemy, but also of proclaiming himself to be the Messiah, the chosen one. So the question is, where is Caiaphas? Well, he's not around, is he? It's Passover. He's probably celebrating Passover with his family, but his pesky father-in-law has interfered, taken matters into his own hands. Jesus has been arrested, even though Caiaphas specifically said, don't arrest him before Passover. So it's late at night. In order for there to be a trial, you need a certain number of council members, 71 for the full Sanhedrin, or 23. It's always an odd number, so there's never a tie when it comes to voting. So they're all waiting around at Caiaphas' father-in-law's house, and you can read about that in John's Gospel. And finally, in the early hours of the morning, we can actually begin the trial. Caiaphas has arrived. Are there enough members of the Sanhedrin to start? Well, probably not. Some of the Sanhedrin had recently become followers of Jesus, so they probably don't want them to attend. So if it's late at night and they go to Caiaphas's house, no one will know. By the time they finish Passover and find out, it will all be over. National Geographic magazine did an investigation into the biblical texts and historical evidence and came to the conclusion it's a complete stitch-up. A kangaroo court, they say, held during the night at Caiaphas's house secretly so that no one would challenge what was going on until morning, and then it would be too late. Now, I'm no expert in giving false testimony at trials, just like to make that perfectly clear, but I imagine it takes several weeks and possibly months to ensure everybody's story is the same, so that when you're cross-examined, you're all telling the same story. But in this case, we don't have a few weeks or a few months, we just have hours, and therefore we read that all the witness statements didn't actually agree. This goes on for many hours, and it's now the early morning. We know this because a cockerel starts crowing, which is important for a story on another occasion. And we're still no further forward in the trial. Caiaphas is getting impatient and annoyed because Jesus actually hasn't said anything during this trial. So Caiaphas asks this statement about Jesus. You say, I'm able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. But Jesus remains silent. The high priest is obviously getting really annoyed at this point, stands up and shouts at Jesus and says, I charge you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God. And Jesus responds, well, you've said so, but I say to all of you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. Jesus is quoting some passages from the Old Testament which would have infuriated the high priest. Jesus is saying that he is the chosen one, he is the Messiah that everyone is waiting for, and one day he will be sitting at God's right hand. And so we read that the high priest tore his clothes, said he has spoken blasphemy, why do we need any more witnesses? And the Sanhedrin court found Jesus guilty of blasphemy. And since the Romans did not allow the Jewish authorities to kill anyone, Jesus then was brought before Pontius Pilate for punishment. Some people think Jesus is a nice bloke who lived 2,000 years ago and was a great teacher, but he said nothing about being the Messiah, the chosen one. To say that misses the point would be an understatement, because it's the whole point. Jesus didn't just say, I am the one. There's a prophecy about the coming Messiah written 600 years ago before this by Daniel to make absolutely clear what Jesus is talking about to the Sanhedrin. He quotes the prophecy from Daniel word for word, and they would have been familiar with those words and they knew exactly what Jesus was saying, except they didn't like it. They found Jesus guilty of sedition, inciting people to rebel against the state, subversion, undermining power and authority, to be fair, their power and authority, tax evasion, even though Jesus makes it perfectly clear you are to pay your taxes, they accused him of that as well. And of course, blasphemy, claiming to be God, the Messiah, the chosen one. And we'll read about what Pilate thought of those charges in a later part of the Radical King series. There's two things I want to bring to your attention this morning. Firstly, if you're not yet a believer in Jesus, there are three reasons why you might say you don't believe. I mean, there could be lots of reasons, but here's some of them. Firstly, Jesus never said he was the Messiah or Savior or anything like that. Secondly, if you're religious, then you can follow Jesus. It's just that I'm not the religious sort. And thirdly, I need more proof. Well, firstly, Jesus never said he was the Messiah or Savior. As I've said, he actually quotes, this Jesus actually quotes the prophecy about himself. And it's not the only occasion he does this. So let me explain in a bit more detail. The temple we heard about in today's reading and the position of the high priest that we also heard about all ended when the temple was destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD, following the Jewish revolt, which started in 66 AD. Since that time, to the present day, there has been no Jewish high priest. It stopped permanently with the destruction of the temple. So let me paraphrase Jesus' words. This is what Jesus is saying. I am the Messiah, the chosen one. The temple will indeed be destroyed, and I will rebuild it in 3 days. I am that temple. It's my body. The temple building that you use to give sacrifices for the release of sins will be replaced by me. I will be the one perfect sacrifice for all, as stated by the ancient prophets. After 3 days, I will be raised to life, conquering sin and death itself, and thereafter I will sit at the right hand of my Father. Not only that, but the actual temple building in Jerusalem will be destroyed, because there will be no need for a physical temple, and there will be no need for a high priest, for I will be the new high priest. There's a whole book about it. It's called Hebrews, and you can find it in another part of the Bible. Secondly, if you're religious, you can follow Jesus. It's just that I'm not the religious sort. Well, it's probably the opposite. In the Bible passage, we read it was actually the religious leaders that rejected Jesus. And finally, I need more proof. Well, the Sanhedrin had more proof than any other group in history. They had meetings about it. We have a transcript of one of their meetings a week or so earlier. This is what it says. One member of the Sanhedrin asked, "What are we to do? For this man Jesus performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come away, take away our power, all the power that we even have in our temple and our nation." But one of them, Caiaphas, who was the high priest at the time, said, "You know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it is to our advantage that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should be destroyed." And the commentator at the time says this, "He did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he unwittingly prophesied that Jesus would die sacrificially for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also for all God's people everywhere, wherever they are in the world." So from that day on, they made plans to put him to death. So the Jewish leaders were planning to kill Jesus all along. And they especially didn't like when he healed on the Sabbath. Not only that, but Caiaphas and his father-in-law continued after Jesus' death and resurrection to oppose Jesus and his followers. They had more proof than Jesus than probably any other people in history, but they chose not to follow Jesus. So if this morning you decide not to follow Jesus, do not make it for these reasons. It's not only for religious people. Don't say that Jesus never said he was the Messiah. Or don't say, "If only I had more proof than I'd believe." Which brings me to my second point. Why did the Sanhedrin reject Jesus? It wasn't because Jesus didn't say who he said he was. It wasn't because they weren't religious. And it wasn't because they needed more proof. Well, there are probably many reasons. And we have to be careful to make sure we don't fall into the same thinking. A bit like what Matt said last week, we don't want to be like Peter or Judas, so we should not be like Caiaphas or his father-in-law. Here's some of the reasons. Firstly, they looked better than they really were, what we sometimes call illusionary superiority. I don't know whether you do that. I mean, I'm dressed like this. I spent a long time thinking about what I was going to wear. I know that's hard to believe, but I did, because I wanted to look as though, you know, looks as though I know what I'm talking about. What's perhaps even sadder is when I'm at the Six, I will change my clothes. So for a different audience, I will look like some of them, and I will look as though I'm authoritative in front of them as well. But it's all an illusion, really. I haven't changed, have I? I've not really changed on the inside. I'm still exactly the same person. But it's me projecting what I really am. And we all have a temptation to do that, to show that we are actually better than we really are. I was looking back at an old CV. I was clearing out some things. I was looking back at an old CV and all the things I'd done. I thought, I don't even remember whether I'd really done all those things. It was obviously just to impress. So not for this job, by the way. previous jobs in the past. They wanted to be in control. Now, we often think of control. We can always think of leaders, politicians who are in control and abuse their authority. But to be honest, everybody exercises a bit of control. Parents exercise control over the children. It's not long before children learn how to exercise power over their parents. Our workplace, our families are often the place where the real struggles of power lie day to day. You have to realize that power can disappear far easier than it was gained. Putting others first, freely giving credit to others, and owning up to mistakes keep things in perspective. You may have power as a parent, as a leader of a group, as a grandparent, as a supervisor or manager, but with power comes responsibility. Take that responsibility seriously and responsibly, not recklessly and without compassion, as with Caiaphas. And as I said, the sad thing about this story is that Caiaphas and his father-in-law did not give up on their quest. They continued to oppose Jesus and his followers after Jesus' death and resurrection. It's also sad because if you remember, there was a slide, seems like ages ago now, actually it probably was, with all the list of high priests. We read in Acts 6, verse 7, that many priests became disciples of Jesus, but not Caiaphas and Annas. Their religion was now more important than their love. Their religion was more important than compassion, more important than grace, more important than helping people in need, and more important than a relationship with God. Now, don't get me wrong, it's important to go to church, to pray, to read the Bible, to give financially, and give service to others. But sometimes that can replace our personal relationship with Jesus. Jesus didn't die on the cross so that you can panic that it's November and you're about to fail in your task to read the Bible in 1 year. I mean, Caiaphas was a good man. I went to see a play. I've still got the program, The Last Days of Judas Iscariot. I won't bother to go into the plot, but at some point in the story, Caiaphas, the high priest, comes and does a speech because he's found guilty of all kinds of things. And he just shouts out, "I am a good man. I obey religious laws and I help others to obey them." But he absolutely did not understand why those laws were in place. In other words, to point people to God. For example, a day of rest is so important. But what happens when someone needs help? Jesus was accused of healing people on the Sabbath. Now, it's a bit of a touchy subject because we all like to think our way of doing Christianity is the only way and oppose anyone who thinks differently. It could be our Bible version, our song choices, whether we like the organ or guitar, how we think church services should be run, whether we like Saviour being spelt without a U, how we think children's work should be run. They're all important things, and it's important to have an opinion on them. But it's not a relationship. God wants us to have an intimate relationship with us and has done everything, including sending his son to die for us, to ensure we have that relationship. So I suppose my question this morning is, do you have a religion or do you have a relationship? All the religious stuff we do here at Maybridge is supposed to assist you, but it's not the relationship itself. I come from a C of E church, and sometimes, it's a long time ago, but still now, I find things that happen at Maybridge a bit odd. I need to understand that my preference for certain things might actually be helping someone else. But for Caiaphas, it was all about following religious practices. He didn't grasp that these religious practices were supposed to bring him closer to God and recognize Jesus as Lord. And for many, it did, including centurions, high priests, Jewish leaders, and those without high office or status. But not Caiaphas. So don't make the same mistake he did. I'll just end with two things. Firstly, this is how one theologian put it. Many people think Christianity is giving up all the bad things that you love to do and doing all the good things that you don't like to do. But you do them anyway because that's religion and that will get you into heaven. No, not much changes in a person's life like that. A Christian is a person who has a relationship with Jesus. That's when the real change takes place. In my previous church, I used to run a sort of a breakfast church, but it was more like messy church. And someone called Mike Howlett came to speak to me after the service and said, "Phil, that was the worst service." He was in his about 70s. And he said, "This is the worst service I've ever been to in my life, almost bordering on heresy." I thought, oh dear, I know what he's going to do. He's going to report me to the minister, possibly to the bishop. I said, "Mike, what are you going to do?" He said, "I'm coming along next time with my grandchildren." This, I was completely confused. I said, Mike, I've no idea what you're talking about. He said, oh, no, sorry. What I mean is, for me personally, it's not my type of service. I really don't like it. But I absolutely understand who it's for. It's for my grandchildren. And they're coming along. Because that's the service I want them to come to. I said, well, that's very kind of you. What's a bit strange about this story is a couple of months later, I actually met up with the Bishop of Buckingham. And I told him this story. And he's a bishop, so he gave a very unusual reply, because he's a bishop, they do. But you can understand what he's saying. He said, do you know, Phil, I wish we had less Caiaphases in church and more Mike Howletts. So finally, religious practices are supposed to help you, but sometimes they don't. So don't let your religion spoil your relationship with God.